Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Jews and Booze, Alcoholism, Addiction, and Denial in the Jewish World, by Michael Levin, read by Barry Abrams. The survivors only came out of the camps just once. Alcoholics and addicts have to come out every morning. Rabbi Naftali Beer, Rosh Kollel, Boston Kollel. Forward by Rabbi Shais Taub. In Judaism, we often question ideas just to make them stronger, so I would like to be frank about my own question as to why I am writing a foreword to this book. To be sure, the author has done a masterful job at formulating and arguing his thesis. I am even quite sure it will save lives. But it is still not without hesitation that I go along with the idea that I be the one to introduce the reader to this book. You see, as a rabbi who sometimes speaks and writes about recovery from alcoholism and addiction, I have taken great pains to avoid addressing the topic of alcohol abuse in any way and in any forum, and it is exceedingly important to me that I maintain that policy. I understand that this position tends to confuse people, so I will explain that which for me is an absolutely critical distinction, but I will need to do so in two phases. The first point to be made is that while drinking has certainly destroyed countless lives through the ages, alcohol itself remains perfectly kosher. In Jewish mystical terms, alcohol is a neutral energy that can be sanctified through proper use or profaned through improper use. So God created alcohol for a purpose, and we need not vilify it even while there are those individuals for whom it is harmful in any form or amount. Consider that there are people with deadly peanut allergies, and we do not rail against peanuts. The foregoing encapsulates, I think, the Torah's attitude toward alcohol, which should make apparent why I, as a rabbi, feel no need to speak disparagingly about drinking as a whole. But this still does not explain my apprehension about writing the foreword to this book. After all, the author does not condemn all drinking, only the normalization of overindulgent drinking, which the Torah surely also forbids. As stated earlier, alcohol may be sanctified or profaned. Surely the abuse of alcohol, wherever you decide to draw that line, would constitute in the Torah's eyes such a profanation and thus be proscribed. Why then should I as a rabbi hesitate to be associated with condemning something that the Torah forbids? But this brings me to my second point. Conceding the fact that there is some form or degree of drinking that is prohibited by Torah, there are still many wrong and unhelpful ways to communicate that fact, and depending on who you are, or even who people so much as think you are, there may be no productive way at all for you to address the topic. You see, in order to effectively carry a message of recovery from alcoholism, at least to those who really need to hear it, the speaker must not be perceived as one who has an inherently negative feeling toward drinking. So it may be okay for other rabbis to speak about the dangers of overindulgence, but not this rabbi. Hence, over the years, I have declined requests to speak out even against the most universally recognized alcohol-related problems, such as teenage drunkenness on Purim. Others may be able to afford being associated with that kind of message, but I cannot. Does Judaism have an opinion on irresponsible drinking? There is no area of life in which Torah does not offer us guidance, but I leave that for other rabbis to deal with. As a rabbinic voice of empathy and support for those who choose to identify as alcoholics and addicts, I must carefully guard myself from taking any position that would undermine my ability to be helpful, and in this regard, I have taken many of my cues from the world of recovery, particularly the approach of Alcoholics Anonymous. From its inception, the modern recovery movement, which began with the advent of Alcoholics Anonymous in America in the 1930s, was never a temperance movement or even loosely allied with the temperance movements of the time. As anyone familiar with the history of this country is aware, in the early part of the 20th century, voices decrying the perceived evils of drinking made up a social cause powerful enough to lead to the passing of a constitutional amendment prohibiting alcohol. In stark contrast, AA took a decidedly neutral stance on the subject of drinking. The original text of AA, the Big Book, published in 1939, states clearly that members need not avoid gatherings where alcohol is served, and that furthermore may choose to keep alcohol in their homes to serve to non-alcoholic guests. A particularly important passage in the Big Book makes clear the reasoning behind this ambivalence toward drinking. We are careful never to show intolerance or hatred of drinking as an institution. Experience shows that such an attitude is not helpful to anyone. Every new alcoholic looks for this spirit among us and is immensely relieved when he finds we are not witch burners. A spirit of intolerance might repel alcoholics whose lives could have been saved had it not been for such stupidity. We would not even do the cause of temperate drinking any good, for not one drinker in 1,000 likes to be told anything about alcohol by one who hates it. Alcoholics Anonymous, page 102. The reader should now be able to understand why my first thought was not to attach my name to this most worthy project. But as I said, we Jews question ideas to make them stronger, so now that I have shared my question with you, I will share my answer. Having made clear that I have no interest in the topic of alcohol use or abuse, I will tell you now why I am deeply grateful that a book like this finally exists, and also why I think it needed to make its case exactly the way that it does. The reality is that right now there is someone in your neighborhood, your congregation, your school's parent body, or your softball team who is dying from a completely treatable disease called alcoholism. It's a drawn-out and gruesome process of mental, emotional, and bodily collapse that pulls whole families and even communities down with it. It's maddening to so much as stand near it, let alone play any part in it. I don't believe there are words to sufficiently express how absolutely cursed it is, but hateful and pitiful are the best I can manage. And among the most hateful and pitiful things about this consummately hateful and pitiful thing is that, for heaven's sake, it's completely treatable. You could scream. For the love of all that's holy, it's completely treatable. The only catch is that in order to treat it, the sufferer must acknowledge the illness and seek help. And therein lies the hatefulness and pitifulness. One of the main symptoms of this disease is that it is a disease that tells you that you don't have a disease. It's part of the pathology. An alcoholic will use any argument to reason away their problem, often employing deft arguments that would make even the most seasoned Talmudic scholar's head spin. The sheer brain power of alcoholic rationalization is astounding, twisted and perverse, but astounding. As I was told by an old-timer in AA, you know what it means to rationalize? Rational lies. And it is this capacity to rationalize that makes a treatable condition so fatal. You see, alcoholism isn't just a physical allergy to alcohol that causes an abnormal bodily reaction of craving more and more alcohol. If only it were a purely physical disorder, the alcoholic could then avoid triggering it as easily as the one with a peanut allergy avoids an anaphylactic reaction by not eating peanuts. The blasted problem is that alcoholism is also a condition of the mind, and one of its chief symptoms is self-deception. So the overwhelming odds are that someone you know and perhaps even care for is dying right now and making their loved ones' lives a living hell, all because they continue to find reasons to convince themselves that they are not alcoholic. And the Jewish alcoholic has one more excuse and ever-present alibi to explain away their problem. I can't be an alcoholic. I'm Jewish. And when life finally becomes so painful as to force them to momentarily admit defeat, along comes the perfect reason why recovery is not an option. I can't be in recovery. I'm Jewish. So without condemning drinking, I think that we as a community have to ask ourselves if we wish to be party to perpetuating attitudes about Jewish drinking that will kill some of our friends and loved ones. Is everyone who abuses alcohol an alcoholic? Certainly not. In my experience, most can and do stop when given sufficient reason to do so. It is only a small fraction of people who drink inappropriately that are real alcoholics in need of recovery. Those who cannot stop even when it jeopardizes everything that is dear to them. But here's the thing. Even if it's just one person you know, and statistically speaking, it's certainly more than just one person who is fueling their self-deception by repeating a bunch of tired old cultural myths about Jews not being alcoholics, don't you think at least one book should once and for all systematically deconstruct all of those harmful lies? Don't you think there should be at least one source that goes down the line and disabuses us of these notions one by one so that we can no longer deflect the truth that alcoholism can and does destroy Jewish families on a scale comparable to other communities? Shouldn't someone set the record straight about this for once? I think so. And again, my reason is not because I have any opinion about the Kiddush clubs. I really couldn't care less about them. What I cannot countenance is that we as a community would create plausible deniability for the person who is dying a slow and entirely preventable death, or that when they finally do consider the fact that they may need help, quickly dismiss the thought because treatment is somehow even less Jewish than the disease itself. That's why I am so incredibly relieved that Michael Levin has taken on this task. I would never have done it myself, but now that someone finally did it, I believe that every responsible member of the Jewish community needs to at least know that this book exists. Not everybody will read this book. That's okay. But there needs to be a collective awareness that a comprehensive case has finally been set to writing proving that we as Jews are not immune from alcoholism and that a culture normalizing alcoholism while stigmatizing recovery has particularly exacerbated that which is a universal problem. I trust that those who read this book will find it easy and pleasant to read, but quite difficult to live with. And that is as it should be. This book should disturb all of us until the culture changes enough that a book like this becomes outdated. What is a culture? People make up a culture. We change the culture by changing people, beginning with ourselves. Yes, alcoholics will always look for excuses, but let us not be able to say that the Jewish community served up those excuses on a silver platter. Choosing recovery is hard enough without the community collectively enabling. Instead, let's strive to be a model of healthy attitudes toward alcoholism and recovery. I do not think we will eradicate alcoholism until Moshiach comes, but until then, we should be able to pride ourselves on creating a culture where those who need help are able to recognize it and get that help sooner. Before I conclude, I would like to briefly mention a point that is separate from all of the aforementioned. The author makes a compelling argument that untreated emotional pain and trauma in multi-generational Holocaust families may also be an underlying cause of alcoholism and addiction. Although I am by no means qualified to evaluate such a statement, I find the idea fascinating, and it rings rather true to me. I pray that this book might find the right audience who can see to it that this matter will be adequately addressed, not only by funding studies, but more importantly by providing the expansion of desperately needed social services to families who suffer. May we soon see the day when all suffering is but a dreamlike memory. Rabbi Shais Taub. Why I wrote this book. His name was David. He came from a well-known and well-respected Flatbush family, and he was my best friend. And he died with a needle in his arm. When it happened, I felt responsible for his death. He had overdosed on heroin, as if there's an appropriate dose for a drug like that, and he was found in his apartment one summer day several days after he had died. He left behind a wife and a beautiful daughter. Why did I feel responsible? Because I'd seen the signs. His erratic behavior, his failure to attend minyan, his failure to answer the phone. I tried to talk with him about it, but he would always blow me off. He was a social user, he would tell me. He had it under control. He was fine. And then one day, he wasn't fine. For a full year, I blamed myself. Why couldn't I have gotten through to him? Why didn't I try to convince him to go to rehab, whatever that was? Why couldn't I have gotten him to see the damage he was doing in his own home and to his parents, friends, and community? I later learned that given the true nature of addiction, I was powerless to interfere with his addiction, which I heard described as suicide on the installment plan. There was nothing I could have said or done to prevent his death or even to slow his addiction. Over time, I learned to release the guilt, but I couldn't let go of the loss. In order to find some meaning in David's death, I was advised to study alcoholism and addiction and maybe find a way to help people who were in David's position or in his wife's position. So I did. I read book after book, spoke to addicts and counselors, and attended open 12-step meetings where I listened to alcoholics and addicts tell their own stories. I was hooked, no pun intended. And for more than 30 years, I have served as a volunteer addiction counselor, not as my profession, but as my avocation, as my kapora, or atonement. Kapora for what, exactly? For what I still consider my failure to act more decisively when I knew that David's life was circling the drain. Over those decades, it has been my privilege to sit with addicts and alcoholics and help point them toward the path of recovery. I've also spent innumerable hours with parents, spouses, and siblings of addicts and alcoholics. I've shared with them what I've learned about what they can do to take care of themselves and what they can and cannot do for their loved ones still drinking or drugging. I grew up in secular America and became observant while in college, so I've seen both sides of the fence, secular and religious Judaism, and I've seen addiction and alcoholism in both of those worlds. We Jews aren't any more or less prone to addiction than our non-Jewish counterparts, but it's possible that we Jews, secular and religious alike, have a harder time than other people getting help. The purpose of this book is not to point out some sort of scandal or to criticize anyone or any Jewish community. Chas v'shalom, heaven forbid. Instead, I want to share with my fellow Jews what I learned after David's death. I want to carry the message, as it's said in recovery speak, about what addiction is, what alcoholism is, what recovery is, and what denial is. The goal is to reduce the unnecessary suffering that exists in our communities because of the twin scourges of alcoholism and addiction. Maybe you know someone who's suffering, an addict, an alcoholic, a loved one. Maybe you want to help, or maybe you just want to understand what's really going on so you can protect yourself. This is the book I wish I could have read before David died. Instead, this book is for you. Chapter 1. The Star of David Syndrome. Ever hear someone say, "Jews aren't alcoholics or addicts. That's a Gentile thing." The belief that Jews are safe from addiction has pervaded our communities for longer than you can imagine. Even when addiction might be staring you in the face, we have our ways of brushing it under the rug. We could call the phenomenon of Jewish denial about addiction the Star of David Syndrome. We somehow believe that being Jewish is a guard against drinking too much, eating too much, gambling too much, or indulging in inappropriate sexual relationships. Wherever we are on the religious spectrum, we don't believe Jews are capable of such things because of our superior culture or our religious observance. Interestingly, there is another group that tends to deny that it has any issues. When it comes to addiction in general, it's often said that the denial is bigger than the disease. In other words, most people with alcohol, drug, gambling, eating, or spending problems don't want to acknowledge those problems to themselves or to anyone else. As one of the key pieces of recovery literature states, who cares to admit complete defeat? Most alcoholics and addicts tell themselves they can beat their habit, that they aren't that bad, that they aren't really addicted, that they aren't hurting anyone but themselves or a variety of similar delusions. Addiction is unusual in that way. It's a disease no one wants to admit to having. We will use the terms alcoholics and addicts interchangeably. The distinctions between the two aren't significant for the purpose of the discussion in this book. People diagnosed with cancer, heart ailments, liver problems, lung issues, and similar maladies don't tell their doctor, "You're wrong, I don't have that." They may be shocked, They may be frightened, or they may ask for a second opinion, but generally, when people are diagnosed with a life-threatening disease, they just want to know what they can do to overcome it. Not so with addiction. The addictive life, however damaging it may be, is the normal life for the addict. To any rational person, drinking oneself to death, racking up huge credit card debt, eating to the point of obesity, or overeating and forcing oneself to throw up are insane choices to make. But to the addict, this is normal. In the Jewish community, we have our own bad habits that we like to deny. We like to deny that any of our community leaders could be sex offenders. We like to deny that though we claim to be spiritually oriented, in some communities, image is everything. And perhaps most importantly, we like to deny that addiction is with us, and with us in a big way. As in other areas of life, our denial gives way to stigma. Stigma against the few people who admit to or are known to have a problem. As a result, we reinforce our denial by hiding even more. Practically every individual in the Jewish community who has an addiction wants to hide it instead of acknowledging it, asking for help, and treating it. The fear of ostracism is so great that we would rather suffer in silence. Families don't want to admit that a parent or child has a problem with alcohol or drugs or gambling or pain medicine or any other addictive behavior or substance. It's even worse in the Orthodox world, of which I am a member. That's because the social pressure to appear heimish is so intense. A hard-to-translate Yiddish term that essentially means beyond criticism even by highly critical fellow Jews. An Orthodox Jewish doctor, a friend of mine, served at an Orthodox Jewish sleepaway camp. He told me that one camper had gone into a diabetic coma and was 15 minutes from death when he was discovered. His parents had not informed the camp that the boy was a diabetic. When the doctor asked why, after he had saved the boy's life, the mother explained, "We didn't want word to get out in the community that he was diabetic. We were afraid of what people would say." The world of shidduchim, or the Orthodox dating world, places so much pressure on families to present a perfect background that Orthodox Jews are rightly afraid that if they admit that a family member has a problem, the children won't be able to get married. One Orthodox man who got sober was told he could no longer drive carpool because of his drinking problem. Nobody had a concern about him driving kids when he was still drinking, and they all knew the open secret that he was a fall-down drunk. But once word got out that he was sober, he was kicked out of the carpool rotation. You can't make this stuff up. People are terrified if they tell the truth about their addictive behaviors, they will be shunned, thrown out of school, out of the community, or worse. Why do addicts live in denial? One reason they won't admit the painful truth about themselves is because they are afraid they will be judged. Unfortunately, in many corners of the Jewish community, they will be judged, swiftly, harshly, and most likely permanently, with the stigma falling on their family members too. While denial is a fundamental aspect of addiction for addicts and alcoholics of all religions, races, and socioeconomic backgrounds, it's an even worse situation for Jews. It comes out in the end. Addicts often act as if they live in a bubble. They think that no one else can see what they're doing and that no one else knows that they're getting away with it. In reality, they may be getting away with things for a while, but eventually, the truth comes crashing down upon them. They turn up drunk, hungover, or fail to show up to a work commitment or a family or religious obligation. They eat so much they can't fit into their clothes. They leave a browser open, or the paycheck never makes it from the workplace to the home because it got swallowed up along the way at the liquor store, the bar, the bookie joint. Now conveniently available online 24/7 for your gambling pleasure, the drive-through Krispy Kreme or the crack house. One of my friends used to take his young daughter with him when he went to downtown Los Angeles in the middle of the night to score drugs. He would raise the hood of his car so his daughter couldn't witness the transaction, and then he died with a needle in his arm. His hiding came to nothing. A heartbreaking article in the Atlanta Jewish Times tells the devastating story of five young Jews in their 20s and 30s who died of heroin overdoses, as if there were a proper dose for heroin. Leah R. Harrison, Trapped in Atlanta's Jewish Heroin Triangle, AtlantaJewishTimes.com, August 31, 2016, AtlantaJewishTimes.com/trapped-atlantas-heroin-triangle/. They're all buried in the same cemetery, and the parents only met because the graves of the young people were in the same part of the cemetery. Sadly, this doesn't only happen in Atlanta. A young Orthodox woman had four children with her husband before divorcing him for his total relapse into drug addiction. She later buried him, the father of those children, when he died of an overdose. The truth comes out in the end. Our denial does not suppress reality. It only pressurizes it. So when it is eventually released, it hits our community with the force of dynamite. Every funeral of a teen, every funeral of a parent, every DUI that risks the lives of not only the driver but others on the road, every incarceration, every family whose father fails to be present because he has passed out drunk on the couch, will testify against us eventually. We are stopping our addicts from stopping. Addiction is a lonely, painful, brutal, selfish way to live. The activity or substance that initially brought relief to the addict boomerangs on the user, causing absolute destruction to that person's reputation, family, school, or community. Not to mention the din v'cheshbon, the heavenly accounting, later on. Given the high price of addiction, you would think most addicts would want to stop. And a lot of the time they do. But how are they supposed to stop if telling the truth about themselves to a spouse, a loved one, a rabbi, or a Rosh Yeshiva, head of a Talmudic seminary, can so often lead to blame, hostility, ostracism, or even exile? In some Jewish communities, families with an addicted or alcoholic child ship him off to rehab, usually in another part of the country, and pretend he doesn't exist. It's like a Soviet-style disappearance. That's what you can get for putting your hand up and saying, "I have a problem." Under those circumstances, it becomes easier for the addict to keep on using, drinking, or acting out. In a community where the stigma of addiction is so huge, the guilt around having an addiction is compounded, fueling even more addictive behavior. At the same time, the fear of ostracism makes it nearly impossible to confess to a problem and seek help. It's said that all alcoholics and addicts stop drinking or using. The lucky ones get to stop during their lifetimes. The unlucky ones end up like my L.A. friend with a needle in his arm, robbed and murdered when they go to score drugs, or humiliated because of a drunk driving arrest. To think that these things aren't happening in our community is to invoke a communal level of denial that far outstrips the denial practiced by any addict or alcoholic. This is no way for us to live as a people. This is no way for families to live. This is no way for individuals to live. Time to tell the truth. It's time for us to surrender the myth of the Star of David syndrome, the idea that being Jewish somehow protects us from the crises and catastrophes that addiction imposes on individuals, families, and communities. We have to tell the truth about ourselves. When it comes to alcoholism, drug abuse, impulsive overeating, impulsive spending, and the like, we are prone to stumble like any other human being. On Yom Kippur, we sing the Ashamnu as a community, and often quite loudly. We are rejoicing in our humanity, in our imperfections, and in our certainty that despite whatever bad things we have done, a loving God will forgive us, will embrace us, and will help us to do better. It's time to apply that same Ashamnu mentality to addiction. It's time for us to admit, out loud and as a community, that alcoholism and addiction are within our gates, within our yeshivas, within our synagogues, at our Shabbat tables, at our simchas, and be
sample complete. Ready to continue?